Chapter 15. Denouement. Sun blink, tail twitch, weight shifts from hoof to hoof. Enfolded in the herd's calm sweat smell, each eye stares, looking across the narrow valley to the white mountains rising in the east. Small pulse tides surge and ebb at shadows or noises. Heads back down, bison tongues lick the dew, pull in great curls of grass and herbs to be slowly ground down. Curls of smoke play around the edges of the meadow, pricked apart by pine needles on their way down the hill, spread thin by the breeze until the matrix of soot molecules is barely there. But it's enough. Nostrils flare, pupils dilate, bodies stiffen and a staccato of snorts explodes. Tails curl upwards, waving their agitation as figures emerge from the trees. The herd stands its ground, secure with distance. But they have not seen these tall ones before, with their new smells and colours. The people slowly spread out along the brush-edged meadow, while the bison watch, seem uncertain. This is not the way of things. A moment of stillness stretches. Then tensed arms raise, flick, and a flock of reed-thin weapons flit out like birds carrying death on the wing. Tiny stone tips bury themselves forearm deep into furred stomachs, necks, then hooves stumble, flanks crash down. The unhurt bison scatter, hearts battering ribs, even as those same parts of their kin are being sliced into on meadow grass slick with blood. This new people, this new hunt, this new way to fear, will soon move on duskwards. The last Neanderthal has long been imagined, a lonesome soul, their death blinking out the species at a single point in space and time. Though today we know they won partial immortality at the cellular level, their disappearance from the fossil and archaeological record is real. What we still don't understand is how those facts interconnect. Finding answers is extremely challenging. Hominin bones are rare, and despite many advances in dating, the highest resolution for individual radiocarbon measurements is around 500 to 2,000 years, far beyond the generational timescales we're interested in. Researchers have zeroed in on the crucial period when the final Neanderthal fossils and middle Paleolithic layers are found. Recent redating of anomalously young bones from a number of sites have all resulted in older ages. For example, since the 1990s, some of the Vindhya remains had ages around 33 to 28,000 years ago. But reconsideration of the taphonomy and use of collagen amino acid analysis to ensure purer samples pushed them back a good 10 millennia. Similarly, at Spee up in Belgium, dates between 38 and 34.6,000 years ago have been refined to over 40,000. All this makes the extraordinarily young dates from Gorham's Cave in Gibraltar, as recent as 28 to 24,000 years ago, look much less likely, especially as they were done on charcoal, tricky material well before modern purification techniques. Consolidating data from numerous sites points to 40,000 years, if not slightly before, as the point beyond which no reliable evidence for Neanderthals exists. That's the when. What about the where? Europe historically was assumed to be the Neanderthals' heartland and likely place of their last stand. But their true range is far greater. Denisova Cave is more than twice as close to Mongolia's capital, Ulaanbaatar, than to Le Moustier in France. While it doesn't have evidence for late Neanderthals, other sites from the region do suggest that they survived nearly as late as in Europe. Denisova may be the easternmost known site for Neanderthals, but perhaps there wasn't really a border. The steppe and taiga that stretched between Belgium and Beringia, the vast area of land linking northern Asia to Alaska, was an environment they were supremely familiar with. And between 60 and 45,000 years ago, their populations in Europe were definitely expanding, including recolonising Britain. Perhaps there was also a push towards the dawn horizon. And Neanderthal feet once stood on the shores of the Pacific. Repeated intermingling with Denisovans shows that the presence of other hominins in East Asia wasn't necessarily a barrier to movement. Some researchers also see Neanderthal-like traits in some Chinese hominin remains, though they look in other ways like early Homo sapiens. Moreover, aside from generic Levallois technology, most intriguingly, someone between 47 and 42,000 years ago at Jinzitai Cave in China was making artifacts extremely similar to Siberichika assemblages from Chajiskaya and other Neanderthal sites, some 2,500 kilometres or 1,550 miles west in the Altai. It's not entirely unreasonable to imagine that the last breaths to fill Neanderthal lungs were inhaled not at the southern tip of Europe, but somewhere in the vastness of Central or East Asia. The last clearly Neanderthal remains are one thing, but are there any cases of hybrid fossils? During the 1980s and 1990s, before genetic evidence of interbreeding, researchers debated whether some Neanderthal bones younger than 50,000 years ago seemed rather less heavily built. There were even claims of Homo sapiens-like features, hints of jutting chins or more rounded skulls. One site considered in this way was Findia, yet the genome turned out unequivocally to be fully Neanderthal. As Chapter 14 discussed, the range of time and space where interbreeding could have happened has also dramatically extended, making it less likely that very late European Neanderthals would be the only candidates to show hybrid features. The Near East region makes sense as a contact zone, being geographically between Europe and Africa. But establishing that Neanderthals were there at the same time as early Homo sapiens is tricky. Between 200 and 90,000 years ago, they may have alternated, but a partial Homo sapiens skull from Mano Cave in Israel, dating before 55,000 years ago, implies that late Neanderthals at Amud and elsewhere were roughly contemporary with that population. In fact, even though the Mano skull somewhat resembles Upper Paleolithic Homo sapiens from Europe, it also has an occipital bun, one of those bumps above the neck occasionally seen in recent and ancient humans, but found in virtually all Neanderthals. Until genetic extraction from Near Eastern fossils becomes possible, warm climates make it harder, little more can be said. Right now, the Waze jaw remains the only fossil representative anywhere for late interbreeding. However, since it took place up to six generations before his birth, how it manifested physically will be diluted. Bones and genomes have been at the forefront of recent research into the last Neanderthals. But was DNA the only thing they exchanged with us? Layers containing their distinctive technocomplexes also disappear between 45 and 40,000 years ago. What comes afterwards has caused probably the most vexed of all debates. Across Europe and Western Asia, a smattering of strange assemblages overlie the last recognisably Neanderthal layers. They appear to combine Middle Paleolithic flake-based technologies with a much more Upper Paleolithic-style concentration on blades and bladelets. Additionally, there's many more shaped bone, antler, and ivory objects. As Chapter 6 showed, Neanderthals obviously knew how to make blades and bladelets, but these were never their main focus, and similarly, formed bone artifacts are very rare. What's more, the intermediate cultures also contain indisputably symbolic objects, including pierced stones and animal teeth, as well as curious carved rings. Precise chronologies vary geographically. The oldest dates come from the eastern fringes of Europe at around 45,000 years ago. But in its western reaches, they're somewhat younger and persist until around 41 to 40,000 years ago. But in stratigraphic terms, there doesn't seem to have been an overlap. Within any site, Middle Paleolithic assemblages are always below intermediate ones, which are then followed by classically Upper Paleolithic layers. The intermediate cultures seem to sit like ephemeral interregnums between Neanderthal and Homo sapiens dynasties. Their distinctiveness means that prehistorians tended to christen them by a variety of names, often after the type site. There's the Sulatian in Hungary, Boenician in the Czech Republic, Olutsian in Italy, Bachokirian in Bulgaria, and the cobbled together Lincomian, Renisian, Yerge Manuisian identified in Britain, Belgium, and Eastern Europe. The million-dollar question is who made them? The Proto-Aurignacian, which follows intermediate cultures in Europe, has produced Homo sapiens mtDNA from a tooth at Fomane. But skeletal remains are vanishingly rare before this, and frustratingly, many key sites were either excavated over 40 years ago or have obvious signs of disturbance or mixing between layers. With greater understanding of taphonomy, the potential for freeze-thaw shifting of sediments within has become obvious, and so untangling what these cultures really mean requires archaeological contexts of exceptional integrity and a battery of high-resolution analytical methods. One of the first intermediate cultures to be recognised was the Châteauperronian from France and northern Iberia. Mid-19th century railworks between a coal mine and foundry uncovered fossils and artefacts in the Grotte des Fées near Châteauperron, central France. Over the century that followed, similar assemblages elsewhere were classified together. But it was assumed that Neanderthals were too intellectually inferior to produce the blades or bone artefacts they contained. Then came an astonishing find. Roughly midway between Poitiers and Bordeaux, mushroom farmers had been hollowing out the Roche à Pierrot cliffs with tunnels. Building works uncovered something far more precious than fungi: archaeological deposits beneath a collapsed rock shelter. Professional excavations commenced, and completely unexpectedly, in 1979, Neanderthal bones emerged from what looked like a Châteauperronian layer. Known as Saint-Césaire I, that skeleton wasn't alone. Further north in France, at the Grotte du Renne, Arcis-sur-Cure, bones and teeth spread through a series of Châteauperronian layers were also Neanderthal. These revelations presented a paradox for leading theories that saw the Châteauperronian as something that was made by Homo sapiens, who had replaced Neanderthals because they were culturally more advanced. Two competing explanations emerged. Perhaps the Châteauperronian was actually an independent Neanderthal invention, converging on Upper Paleolithic-like features by chance. Or alternatively, it was made by Neanderthals but resulting from some kind of cultural hybridization. Possibilities ranged from full contact to Neanderthals spying on Upper Paleolithic groups or picking through their trash and then figuring out how to copy them. Today, things have grown more complicated. Nearly 100 Châteauperronian sites are now known, from the Paris Basin down to northern Iberia, dating somewhere between 44 and 41,000 years ago. In France, it rapidly follows the youngest Middle Paleolithic layers, but south of the Pyrenees there seems to be a gap of around 2,500 years before it appears. It was definitely over fast everywhere, lasting perhaps one millennium in any particular region. The same separation in time between you and the earliest printed money. Most crucially, excavations of new sites without taphonomic problems have revealed a rather different cultural picture. Middle Paleolithic flakes and tools are only present in Chatalpurini assemblages from old excavations or places where there are signs of disturbance. This means that the apparent transitional character in the technology is far less supported. Detailed studies of these clean Chatalpuronian layers show it was a true laminar world. Blades were retouched on one side, opposite a sharp edge, to make Chatalpuron points, and the makers were highly selective. Blades not up to scratch in size terms were rejected. A key locale is the Quincey rock shelter, about 100 kilometres or 60 miles northwest from Roche à Pierrot. Of the more than 450 cores, fewer than 1% had flake scars. Refitting confirmed the dominance of blade production, which were intended specifically to be retouched into points, of which there were more than 300. Open-air Chatalpuronian sites show the same thing. Canol 2 near Bergerac has a clear separation from underlying Middle Paleolithic archaeology. It was a mass production workshop containing thousands of near pristine artifacts from a very thin layer. Almost a third were refitted, and once again, specialised blade blanks for points were undeniably the goal. Even more significant, Chatalpuronian laminar technology doesn't match the way Neanderthals made blades or bladelets, and more closely resembles proto-origination approaches. Sometimes waste flakes from preparation or maintenance of blade cores were casually used, occasionally even retouched. But in total contrast to Neanderthals, Chatalpuronians had no systematic interest in flake production. Some researchers have seen similarities between tools called backed knives found in some biface and discoid assemblages, and proposed them as evidence for a direct technological ancestry to Chatalpuron points. But others have noted that backed knives are technologically completely different, with their blade-like parallel scars formed by chance when napping across the surface of flake cores. What's more, in a number of sites, there is a final Middle Paleolithic Levallois phase in between layers with backed knives and the Chatalpuronian. This implies a significant separation in time, making a direct connection even less plausible. Today, Saint-Césaire and Arcis-sur-Cure remain the only Chatalpuronian, or indeed any intermediate culture sites with Neanderthal associations. The Grotte du Renne was excavated over 30 years ago with good practice for the time, but lacked precise location recording and sediment studies. This means that skeletal fragments from at least six Neanderthals only have the layer and grid square recorded. Most were towards the bottom of the Chatalpuronian layer, but others came from higher up, which was taken to mean Neanderthals were present through its entire duration. However, as well as stone blocks and technologically Middle Paleolithic artefacts occurring well up into the Chatalpuronian, there are also Chatalpuron knives and bone awls, carved piercing tools, in the underlying Middle Paleolithic layer. This is strongly suggestive of disturbance or movements between the two deposits. So far, refitting of lithics has been limited, but it identified that fragments were also moving several tens of centimetres between the different Chatalpuronian layers. Furthermore, radiocarbon dates produced anomalously ancient results, older than 48,000 years ago, from well into the Chatalpuronian. Put together, the Grotte du Renne contains worrying evidence that things were being displaced both within and across the crucial layers. The most recent research used ZooMS analysis to identify more Neanderthal remains, including the breastfeeding baby girl already mentioned, and they date to around 42,000 years ago. These new bones may relate to those already known from an infant, including skull, jaw, and upper body parts, which might imply relatively little disturbance. But given the other evidence for objects moving, it's not entirely out of the question that the Neanderthal bones were jumbled upwards from an original Middle Paleolithic context. While it's been proposed that the Chatelperronians themselves could have caused the trouble by digging, geothermal processes from freezing sediment can also move things over 1.5 meters or 5 feet vertically. And there's plenty of evidence that the Chatelperronian occurred during an exceptionally cold period. What's really needed to be secure in interpreting Grotte du Renne is a complete refitting analysis. The Saint-Césaire Neanderthal, in contrast, seemed a more solid case. When first found, it was removed as a block of sediment 1 metre or 1.1 yards across to be excavated in the lab. Full details on the position and condition of the skeleton have, however, never been published, although direct dating produced results around 42 to 40.6,000 years ago, potentially an underestimate due to low collagen. But Saint-Césaire has also recently been subject to critical reanalysis, raising more red flags over whether the Neanderthal here was genuinely in an intact Chatelperronian layer. The highly crushed bones themselves indicate complex taphonomy and erosion, with the uppermost side of the face missing despite the teeth remaining. But meticulous research on the artifacts, published in 2018, also suggests things aren't as simple as they once seemed. While only about 15% of the 40,000 lithics excavated in the 1970s were recorded in 3D, it was possible to digitally reconstruct the stratigraphic boundaries and reassign other artifacts to their correct layer. The results showed that almost all the lithics from the Chatelperronian layer weren't related to blade production at all, but Levallois and discoid. Additionally, all the Middle Paleolithic type retouched tools were made on flakes, not blades. Even more striking, while much of the layer was jumbled and pointed to mixing, all the lithics from within the skeleton sediment block were technologically Middle Paleolithic. A gigantic refitting program found that just 4% of the lithic fragments could be reunited, compared to Canol 2, which is 9 times higher. This already suggested that the layers weren't intact, which was confirmed by spatial refit data that revealed objects had moved several meters along the cliff and down the slope. Adding in the fact that everything in the supposed Chatelperronian layer was far more battered, it looks as if some kind of massive sediment flow had come off the cliffs and mixed things up. The researchers proposed a new explanation for Saint-Césaire. There had been a Chatelperronian layer, but it was thin and right on top of a rich Middle Paleolithic layer. Geological disturbance later thoroughly mixed the two. The skeleton is, however, still something of a mystery. The body must have been deposited before the mixing, since the lithics and rocks around it are just as damaged as everything else. And this would also explain the erosion of the skull's left side. But although the 1970s field journal shows it was found at the base of what they believed to be the Chatelperronian layer, it's impossible now to be sure if it was sticking up from the Middle Paleolithic layer or had been really deposited during the Chatelperronian. It seems that neither Grotte du Renne nor Saint-Césaire are entirely secure contexts connecting Neanderthals to the Chatelperronian. This means that, at present, we don't know who made it. And it also means that in France and northern Spain, the culture of the last identifiable Neanderthals was very much in the mould of what they'd been doing for tens of millennia. Discoid and Lefalwa assemblages. And while in a number of places they were showing interest in pigment, fossil shells, markings, and some shaped bone tools, like l'issoir, the Château Perronian at Grotte du Renne and elsewhere unarguably contains artefacts that go beyond this. Finely manufactured bone tools include tubes made from bird limbs, pierced and grooved deer, fox, and wolf teeth beads, and enigmatic carved, polished, and engraved mammoth ivory rings. Still, vague hints at possible cultural contacts exist, but with ideas moving in the opposite direction. Perhaps it was Château Perronians who picked up an interest in large raptors from Neanderthals, shown by the butchered eagle toe at Cova Foradada in northern Spain. And perhaps they learned from Neanderthals how to make l'issoir, then decorated them with their own V-shaped engravings. The Château Perronian hogged attention for a long time, but debates over possible Neanderthal authorship of other intermediate cultures have also evolved over the decades. One is the Ulutzian, largely found in Italy, understanding of which has advanced thanks to two terrifying natural disasters between 46.5 and 39.7 thousand years ago. The first originated on the tiny island of Pantelleria, a rocky volcanic massif last active in 1891 that tumbles like a pebble off Sicily's soul. A huge eruption happened between 46.5 and 44.5 thousand years ago, blowing out a massive caldera and pluming ash up into the sky. Prevailing winds sifted these deposits over large parts of Italy, and they're visible in archaeological sites as the Green Tuff. Northeast, from Pantelleria, are the famous Phlegraean fields near Naples, Italy, which also hosted an enormous volcanic eruption somewhere between 40 and 39.7 thousand years ago. The ashes were even thicker and more widespread than the Green Tuff, fluttering down onto people in southern Italy, through the Mediterranean, and as far as parts of Russia. Known as the Campanian Ignimbrite, or CI, this layer is also distinctive enough to identify microscopically and chemically. The Green Tuff and CI have incredible value to archaeologists because they're very brief temporal markers bracketing the Ulusian. Initially viewed as an indigenous Neanderthal development, renewed research into the Ulusian is suggesting things aren't so simple. There are far fewer sites than the Château Perronian, under 30, but they're found all over Italy, bar the northwest. They also extend eastwards into the Balkans and Greece. Based on the Green Tuff, the CI, and radiocarbon dating, it seems that the oldest Ulusian only began after 44.5 thousand years ago. The best known site is Cavallo Cave in Apulia, the hottest and driest Italian region today. Odd crescent-shaped lithics found here and at other sites from the 1960s onwards came to define the Ulusian around the same time as the Château Perronian was being discussed. But several decades of detailed technological studies show them to be two completely different phenomena. Ulusians didn't have systematic, sequential technologies like Lavalwa or Discoid. There are a few centripetally worked cores, but largely they combined casual napping with an unusual technique. Known as bipolar, this involved balancing one end of a core on a stone anvil, then whacking straight downwards. Doing this gives hardly any control over the shape of products, which also tend to have splintered ends. But it's fine for less than ideal stone, like the slabs and small imported pebbles at Cavallo. Bipolar flakes are just as ready to use as discoid flakes or blades, and if what you're after is very small, flat segments, it's ideal. And this is what the Ulusians wanted. Their standout artifacts are crescent-shaped tools called lunates. Made on flat flake or blade segments, by retouching inwards towards the thickest point. This left a curved back opposite the long, sharp edge. Olusians also had organic technology, though it's not very common. In addition to bone retouches, they also made cylindrical objects finely pointed at one or both ends, often quite small and some tiny. A couple are less than 5 millimetres or 0.2 inches wide. Where identifiable, all are horse or deer, and some were repeatedly resharpened. They probably weren't weapon tips, but were likely awls for making holes in medium tough materials like leather and softer stuff such as furs. Some of the smallest might even be fishing tackle. There's also some evidence for aesthetic and symbolic artefacts. Tiny shells, some apparently pierced, come from Cavallo. Other species with tubular shells were snapped and sawn to make tiny segments, probably used decoratively. So far, however, there's no carved bone or antler objects, beads, or decorated or painted objects. The Olusian is interesting because it shows the complexity in picking out technological differences and similarities to the preceding Middle Paleolithic. Bipolar napping is sometimes found in those assemblages, but it's never the headline act. Most strikingly, there are also Middle Paleolithic layers at Cavallo that contain bipolar artefacts, but also Levallois, showing that Neanderthals were perfectly able to use the poor quality stone for trickier napping methods. And in contrast to Neanderthals, who selected between rock types for different activities when given the choice, Olusians were so focused on bipolar napping, segments and lunates, that they did it across all different rock types. What was this obsessiveness about? Understanding the function of the segments has been key and has led to a remarkable conclusion. A few were hafted and used as tools to cut and scrape vegetable and animal materials, but impact damage strongly suggests most were weapons. Some acted as tips, others perhaps barbs along a shaft. Their tiny size, averaging less than 3 centimetres or 1.2 inches long and extremely narrow, points away from spears and towards darts or even arrows. Blocks of red and yellow pigment have been found at two Olusian sites, and since most lunates at Cavallo had red residues, especially on their curved backs, it seems ochre was involved in hafting for a very particular kind of hunting. But what the Olusian does share with the Sethel-Peronian is recent controversy over who made it. In 2011, analysis of two teeth found in the 1960s at Cavallo identified them as Homo sapiens, but based on anatomy, not DNA. Unfortunately, due to their condition, they can't be directly dated, and there have also been criticisms of the security of their original context. One was supposed to come from a hearth at the bottom of the Olusian, where it partly cut down through the green tuff into the Middle Paleolithic layer. The other was apparently from 15 to 20 centimetres or 6 to 8 inches higher. But since they were excavated 60 years ago and never fully published, their precise locations aren't certain. Moreover, the original excavators recognised extensive disturbance in the site from ancient digging and recent looting, and erosion that in places extended through the Olusian layers. It's difficult to be sure the teeth were unaffected by this, and though most researchers accept that the teeth are Homo sapiens, without direct dates and ideally DNA, not all regard them as reliable evidence for who the Olusians were. Another parallel with the Sethel-Peronian comes from tantalising hints at Middle Paleolithic cultural connections that aren't about stone napping. At the cave of La Fabbrica, west central Italy, glue residues have been analysed on Olusian artefacts and shown to contain a mix of pine or conifer resin and animal fat. Neanderthals aren't known to have used that combination, but in 2019, new analysis of residues on the Cavallo fragments found a triple ingredient recipe It combined ochre, plant resin, and beeswax. And as we saw in Chapter 7, the latter two ingredients were used by Italian Neanderthals. It's impossible to be sure whether this is a remarkable convergence or evidence of some cultural contact. But certainly the rest of the Alusian doesn't really share Middle Paleolithic features in either lithics or organics. Neanderthals did occasionally shape bone tools, but there are no parallels approaching the very thin, small, pointed forms in the Alusian. So the Alusian doesn't seem to have directly evolved out of the Middle Paleolithic, yet neither is it laminar like the Chalcopyrrhonian and most Upper Paleolithic cultures. What it does have in common with the latter is a focus on artefacts designed to be retouched. Whether Chalcopyrrhon points were also hafted weapon tips is an interesting possibility. In Italy, the last Neanderthals were gone no later than 43 to 42,000 years ago. And whoever made it, the Alusian itself was over after one or two millennia at the most. But elsewhere in southeastern European regions, there are signs that things weren't always so neat. In some places, the CI ash horizon is found beneath apparently Middle Paleolithic layers, suggesting Neanderthals were potentially still around a couple of centuries after 39,000 years ago. And at Burankaya, a little further along the Crimean mountains from Zaskalnaya, another intermediate culture, the Streletskayan or Eastern Zelotian, is found below a Middle Paleolithic level that dates to 41.1 to 43.9 thousand years ago. Later sites have Homo sapiens remains associated with the Streletskayan, so here too it looks as if Neanderthals did cling on after others had entered their lands. The past couple of decades have proved that secure evidence for genuinely hybrid cultures associated with Neanderthals is very thin indeed. It's not that they weren't savvy enough to make Alusian lunates or Chalcopyrrhon points, but the real difference is conceptual. Those objects were systematically made to exacting standards and methodically retouched because they were part of an integrated system of hunting using composite, mechanically assisted weapons, light spears, dart tips, or even arrows. This is quite unlike what we see in Neanderthals, where, even if some hafted weapons existed, they were thrusting or javelin-like throwing spears. Potential convergences in other materials are also not especially strong. The fact that Italian Neanderthals and Alusians both used resin and beeswax adhesives is very intriguing, but it's isolated. In contrast, the Alusian and Chalcopyrrhonian, covering a couple of millennia at most and many times fewer sites, contain more shaped bone tools than the entire Middle Paleolithic. Even more striking is the frequency and variety of aesthetic and symbolic objects in intermediate cultures compared to the Middle Paleolithic. They're still much rarer than in later Upper Paleolithic cultures, but nothing like the pierced teeth, bones and stones, decorated tools, or carved objects are known to have been made by Neanderthals. There's a last, even more mysterious culture that's worth discussing from southeast France. What makes it so perplexing is that it's some 10,000 years older than the Chalcopyrrhonian and potentially of Neanderthal authorship. Chapter 9 already introduced the key site, Mantrain Cave, where high-resolution soot chronologies accumulated on the walls. What the cave also contains is the richest and best-studied example of the Neronian. It's not just unusual because of its technology, but also because it's sandwiched between typical Neanderthal-associated assemblages. Preceding it is a Kina level, and afterwards come another five Middle Paleolithic layers dating to about 47,000 years ago. At the moment, there are no fossils associated with this strange old culture that give any answers as to who made it. A non-distinctive skull fragment comes from the type site of Neron Cave, 70 kilometres or 40 miles upriver from Mandarin. But it's not got enough collagen for radiocarbon dating and is therefore also unlikely to be suitable for DNA analysis. This means that it's the archaeology that is centre stage, and it's really something. The Mandarin Neronian, under 20 centimetres or 8 inches thick and around 50 metres square or 60 yards square, has produced 60,000 objects, plus probably millions of tiny pieces of napping debris. Technologically, it looks completely unlike anything else during this time period in Western Europe, combining blades, bladelets, and Levallois-like points. Crucially, they're made in sequence on the same cores, proving they were an integrated technological system. And the richness of the assemblage is extraordinary. There are some 1,300 points, which astonishingly is more than all European Middle Paleolithic sites combined. While they vary in shape, they were systematically made apparently in three sizes, some left unaltered, others retouched steeply. A third are less than 3 centimetres or 1.2 inches long, and therefore microlithic. But others are so diminutive, 8 to 15 millimetres or 0.3 to 0.6 inches long, and 2 millimetres or 0.08 inches thick, researchers called them nanopoints. Useware analysis confirms even the tiniest were damaged by high-speed impacts. But because weapon shafts must be smaller than the stone tip, they're too small to be used with spears. Moreover, experiments suggest they're too light to achieve useful range without a mechanical boost. We're looking here at something like darts thrown with an atlatl, or for the nanopoints, arrowheads. All these features make the Neronian a lightning bolt out of the blue. In all known Neanderthal assemblages, even if competently made, blades were never overwhelmingly dominant. At Mandarin Cave, about 75% of all artefacts relate to laminar production and points. Similarly, Neanderthals did make very tiny flakes, including using Levallois methods and bladelets in many contexts. But it's typically a response to the stone resources available. Across several hundred thousand years, there's only one object that might be related to propulsive technology. The Salzgitter bone point. It's small, obviously shaped, and thinned at the base, and must surely have been hafted, though how isn't clear. But in Europe, after Mandarin Cave, there are no comparable small lithic points designed for propulsion weapons for more than 10 millennia. Comprehensive dating shows that the Neronian layer was deposited probably 50 to 52,000 years ago, and the soot chronology points to not more than several decades, even just a few years, between it and the preceding Kina layer. Even if there was any technological similarity, there's not enough time for one to develop into the other. Beyond a handful of other Neronian layers in the same region, nothing remotely like it exists for thousands of years and hundreds of kilometres. But what it does resemble are some so-called initial Upper Paleolithic or IUP cultures in the Near East and the borders of Europe. They date around 45 to 50,000 years ago, older than the European intermediate cultures, and the Boeonician of the Czech Republic is especially relevant. It includes Levallois points made on blade cores, and at some sites, the lithics are miniaturised. At least some IUP cultures were made by early Homo sapiens. The Batrachirian in Bulgaria has bones dated to around 46,000 years ago, although technologically it's not as close to the Neronian. It's also clearly several thousand years too young. In theory, there could have been older, cryptic dispersals of early Homo sapiens into Western Europe. Alternatively, an ancient hybrid population is another possibility. The DNA from Ustisham, And other early Homo sapiens bones do indicate that interbreeding was happening before 55,000 years ago. So perhaps populations connected with this moved into Europe from somewhere in Asia. But their numbers must have been tiny, as they left no other trace until the Rhone Valley. But after all this, there is a glimmer of a cultural connection to Neanderthals. The Mandrin Cave Neronian produced one of the largest butchered golden eagle talons from anywhere in Europe. Focusing on raptor claws is not an Upper Paleolithic trend at all, so the fact that it's there in the Middle Paleolithic, Neronian, and one Chatelperronian site is intriguing, given that in lithic terms, they're very clearly different to each other. Scenarios about the Neronian itself would remain speculative until DNA is extracted, potentially from the sediments. But even if it turns out that Neanderthals weren't responsible, it's still extremely interesting because of what it implies about their population dynamics. The Mandrin-Soot chronology shows an extremely rapid shift from a preceding Kina-based tradition to the Neronian. No more than a human lifetime, or even faster. Then, the Neronian itself looks very brief, a thin layer corroborated by only 18 or so occupations within the soot archive. After it ends, the cave was abandoned for many generations, perhaps millennia. Yet, the Neronian wasn't the end of the line. When fires burned once more in Mandrin Cave, they were sat around by people, presumably Neanderthals, making basically Middle Paleolithic artefacts again. In the first post-Neronian phase, the amount of blades and points dramatically drops off, while flake production increases, although they're often still unusually small. The second phase covers four layers, and flakes clearly become larger and essentially look like any other Middle Paleolithic context. The post-Neronian is also notable in two ways. The lithic territory, based on stone sourcing, dramatically shifts, shrinking in size and no longer crossing to the western side of the River Rhone. What's more, the soot chronology points to over 90 occupations and therefore a period of stability. One way of understanding this overall sequence is that, whoever they were, the Neronians displaced the local Neanderthals so thoroughly that the region was emptied out for many generations. But it didn't last, and it didn't extinguish them. At Mandrin Cave, that only came thousands of years later, when the final Middle Paleolithic layer is directly followed, in less than a century, by the Proto-Aurignacian. Endling dreams. What happened at Mandrin Cave tells us that the end of the Middle Paleolithic was far from a simple process in cultural terms. And it would be another 10 millennia until the last known intimate contact between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, as shown in the DNA of the Wasé man. Frustratingly, we don't know exactly where his ancestors met Neanderthals. In two centuries, they could have moved hundreds or thousands of kilometres. And there are no associated artefacts with his jaw. What should we even call somebody like Wasé? How many Neanderthal ancestors, and how close in time defines hybridity? Was his mixed ancestor the only one in their group, or part of a wider pattern? Did they become part of stories passed down until his own generation? Until more intact sites containing fossils with extractable DNA are found, these thoughts must remain mostly musings. But at least one thing is clear. There wasn't wholesale merging of populations, or of cultures. No Neanderthals across their whole range during the crucial period between 80 and 40,000 years ago have any genetic hints of hybridizing. And not all early Homo sapiens individuals show it either. Neither the mtDNA from Bachoquiro, nor a Proto-Aurignacian tooth at Fumane, almost the same age as Wasé. But the genetic patterns in living people tell us assimilation to some degree did happen. though Neanderthals remained physically distinct even in their last visible skeletal remains, the scale and repetition of interbreeding, plus the range of retained genes in us, means they were, and are, human. Biologically speaking, individuals who can mate and create viable offspring are the same species. Chimpanzees and bonobos, who are both physically and socially quite different, have only been separated since around 850,000 years ago, roughly the same time that our own ancestors separated from the lineage that would lead to Neanderthals and Denisovans. Modern zoology's concept of allotaxa may be more appropriate for what Neanderthals were to us. Closely related species that vary in bodies and behaviours yet can also reproduce. Yaks and cattle are an example, and it was certainly happening in Pleistocene fauna too. Different types of mammoths sometimes hybridised, while living brown bears were recently found to preserve a small percentage of cave bear DNA. And in recent cases recorded between polar and grizzly bears, biologists also observed backbreeding going on between hybrids and both parent species. The fundamental conclusion to draw about the end of the Neanderthals is to expect the unexpected. Despite enormous advances in chronologies, technological analysis, and species identification over the past few decades, in many ways, there are more questions than ever. Some of the more intriguing uncertainties that remain include what caused the splitting, dispersing, and perhaps even replacements visible in the Neanderthal metapopulation from MIS5. Climatic impact is a possibility, with the rapid temperature rise towards the hothouse and hippo's Eemian peak, followed by a world in flux, experiencing massive temperature jumps of 11 to 16 degrees centigrade. The population changes are mirrored in the archaeology too, with a proliferation of techno-complexes and regional traditions between 125 and 45,000 years ago. Another theme that needs far more unpicking is the processes that led to encounters between Neanderthals and other species, particularly early Homo sapiens. We are prone to paint ourselves as victors, but outside Africa, we nearly went extinct at least once and suffered a major population crash around 70,000 years ago, just before the majority of interbreeding with Neanderthals. Moreover, despite dispersing populations obviously spreading all the way into Australia by 65,000 years ago, adapting to arid deserts and wet mountain forests, even an ocean crossing to Indonesia, there's no clear sign of Homo sapiens in Central or Western Europe until more than 20,000 years later. Perhaps that land was already taken and Neanderthals were successful enough, at least for a while, to prevent others coming in. Yet there is the Neronian joker in the pack, reminding us that what we can make out archaeologically is far from the whole story. A further irony is that long-standing claims that early Homo sapiens possessed some intrinsic superiority are far from tenable. The Wazeyman's people went extinct in Europe and are instead closer to today's indigenous Americans and East Asians. Even more striking is the Ustashum man. He lived either just before or just after the deepest genetic division into what would become ancient Eastern and Western Eurasian Homo sapiens lineages. Yet, he's unrelated to almost any living people. Furthermore, during the 25,000 years after Wazey, it appears that successive Upper Paleolithic populations totally replaced each other and were then replaced in their turn by later prehistoric cultures. Parisians, Londoners, or Berliners today, with ostensibly European heritage, have very little connection even to Mesolithic people just 10,000 years ago. The vast majority of their DNA comes from a massive influx of Western Asian peoples during the Neolithic. This means that many of the first Homo sapiens populations are more extinct than the Neanderthals. Not a great sign of evolutionary dominance. Further paradigm shifts doubtless lie ahead, with more ancient DNA samples. Our present evidence of interbreeding may be somewhat like the early history of exoplanet discoveries, where such objects were assumed to be rare. Yet several decades on, it appears there are more planets in our galaxy than stars. Today we know Eurasia was always a melting pot, home to hundreds, perhaps thousands of hybrid children. Neanderthal sites may be secretly hosting more evidence of them, or their close descendants, scattered among identified bone fragments or cave sediments. The fate of the Neanderthals has monopolised enormous amounts of attention, yet it may be the least interesting thing about them. Perspectives benefit from being flipped. Their last 100,000 years was a time of great challenges, but rather than a prologue to a Neanderthal swan song, it was the scene of engagements with new opportunities. By 20,000 years ago, we were alone on the surface of this planet. Nonetheless, the Neanderthals still lived, after a fashion. Even as our encounters fell out of all memory, our blood and our babies still contain the fruits of interactions with the universe's other experiments in being human. Bones and stones long waited underground for us to rediscover our shared future. And when we finally did, everything changed.